into the meat, which she took from my hand. I thought that if I could get 15 tablets down her daily, there was a good chance that her wound would not go septic. Her ear drooped, suggesting that the muscles had been injured, and she constantly shook her head to get rid of the oozing liquid. Jesper, who'd been the cause of the encounter, was very friendly. He licked me and several times tilted his head, looking straight at me for a long time. There is a belief that the members of the cat tribe can never look one in the face for any length of time. This is not true of Elsa, and her sisters, or of the cubs. Indeed, I've found that they convey their feelings by the varying expressions of their eyes far more explicitly than we do in words. After Elsa had settled down for the night, a lion began calling. This seemed to alarm her, and she shortly afterwards went off with the cubs. I was glad when they all returned during the following afternoon. Jesper occasionally poked his nose into my back, in a friendly fashion, but apparently Elsa did not approve, for she placed herself between him and me. Towards evening, Nuru herded the goats towards the truck. This was the first time I saw the cubs take any interest in them. We had, of course, been careful to avoid any contact between the cubs and living goats, and they had never before reacted to their bleating. During the night, I heard two lions grunting as they cracked the bones of a carcass, which was lying in front of George's tent. They spent a long time over their meal, and only went off at dawn when the boys began talking in the kitchen. Elsa kept away for some days. I thought her absence was explained by the presence of the pair who had remained nearby and who the following night grunted round the goat truck. The boys and I made several searches for Elsa, but these were unsuccessful. After Elsa had been absent for 4 days, I became very anxious, for her wound must be a very big handicap to her in hunting, and I was afraid also that the poachers might do her some harm. When on the evening of the 20th of July I saw vultures circling, my heart sank. We went to investigate, but all we found was more evidence of the poachers. They had made hides near to every drinking place on both sides of the river. We also found the ashes of recent fires and charred animal bones. 3 hours later, I returned to camp to be told by 2 game scouts, whom the warden had just sent to catch the poachers, that they had seen Elsa and the cubs under a bush on the opposite side of the river, about a mile inland. She was lying in the shade, and the cubs were asleep. She had seen the men approach, but had not moved. This sounded odd, unless she was so ill that she did not care even if strangers were close by. Makede suggested that we should take some meat to her, but not enough to satisfy her hunger, and so tempt her to come back to camp. As we approached her lie-up, I signalled to the men to stay behind and call to her. She emerged, walking slowly, her head bent low to one side. I was surprised and alarmed that she should have settled in such an exposed place where she could easily be seen by poachers. I noticed that her ear had gone septic and was discharging pus. She was obviously in great pain, and when she shook her head as she did very often, it sounded as if her ear were full of liquid. Besides this, both she and little Elsa were covered with blowflies. I was able to rid Elsa of hers, but the cub was far too wild to let me help her. Meanwhile, she and her brothers fought over the section of carcass we'd brought them, and soon there was nothing left for Elsa but polished bones. Jesper thanked me for his meal by licking my hand with his rough tongue. I tried to induce Elsa to come back to camp by calling Swahili words she was familiar with, which meant water, food, meat, but as she did not move, went home without her. By now, I'd been 3 weeks alone in camp, and George was overdue. In his absence, wild lions prowled round the camp every night, and although Makede and Ibrahim could have used their rifles if an emergency arose, I was nervous about the safety of the boys. At last George arrived, and was greeted by the roars of the strange lion. Hearing that Elsa had not been seen for several days, he decided to go and look for her, and he was also determined to try to scare off the strange lion and his fierce lioness. We did not know what Elsa had done to displease this disagreeable beast. We were pretty sure that she had not competed for the attention of her mate, but had kept strictly to her own young lion. Perhaps Elsa had interfered with her hunting, or her territorial claims, or perhaps the creature was just bad-tempered. Anyway, we were sure now that she had chased Elsa and the cubs over the river and towards the poachers, and that she and her mate had for several days taken over the big rock. We searched upstream on the far side of the river. Here, too, there were plenty of lion pug marks, including those of a lioness with three cubs. They led us 5 miles from camp to a part of the bush which, so far as we knew, Elsa had never visited. As we approached a baobab tree, we heard the sound of startled animals bolting, and the Toto caught a glimpse of the hindquarters of a lion and of three cubs which could have been Elsa's. They were gone in a flash, and though we called and called, there was no response. Next morning, we returned to this place, and within 500 yards saw some very recent spoor of a lion, a lioness, and cubs. This led us up a dry watercourse, then towards some rocks, but before reaching them, the pride had abruptly turned back, run fast to the river and crossed it. After 2 more hours tracking, we found that the pride had reassembled in a sandy watercourse. We kept very quiet till we heard the roar of a lion. He was very close to us. His voice was familiar to us, for we had often heard it at night. He sounded hoarse, and the boys used to say that he must have malaria. It is most unusual for a lion to roar at 11 in the morning. This one was evidently calling to a lioness, whom presently we heard reply from the direction of the barking baboons. Hoping it might be Elsa, we bypassed the hoarse lion and had a good look round, but saw nothing. Finally, tired and thirsty, we sat down and made tea. Here we discussed the 2 possible explanations of Elsa's disappearance. Rather than stay in camp and risk being mauled by the ill-tempered lioness, she might have decided to share the hazards of the hoarse lion's life. That was an optimistic solution to the mystery. A pessimistic alternative was that Elsa had died of her septic ear, and that the cubs had been adopted by a pair of wild lions. On our way back, we saw flocks of vultures around the kitchen lugger, and the boys went on ahead to inspect the kill. I hung back, dreading to learn what they had discovered, but soon they shouted that they had found the carcass of a lesser kudu, which had probably been killed during the night by wild dogs. We spent the next 2 days covering the boundaries of Elsa's territory, partly on foot and partly by car. George left in the last week of July, and I continued to look for Elsa. It was now over a fortnight since the fierce lioness had attacked her, and except for the occasion when the game scout had found her in the bush, she had not been seen, nor had there been any trace of the cubs. Feeling miserable, I asked Makede whether he loved Elsa. He looked startled, but replied warmly, "Where is she that I could love her?" This made me even more depressed. Makede watched me, scolded me more angrily. "You have nothing but death in your mind. You think of death, you speak of death, and you behave as though there was no Mungo, God, who looked after everything. Can't you trust him to look after Elsa?" Encouraged, I got up and went on with the search, but 2 days passed without bringing any result. On the evening of the 16th day since Elsa and the cubs had disappeared, I sat in the dark straining my ears for any hopeful sound. Then suddenly, there was a swift movement, and I was nearly knocked off my chair by Elsa's affectionate greeting. She looked thin, but fit, and the wound in her ear was healing from outside, though the centre was still septic. I was immensely relieved to know that she was well, but where were the cubs? Her visit only lasted 30 minutes, and I waited long into the night, hoping that she might return with them. At dawn, I was woken by the meowing of the cubs, and saw them crawling close to my thorn enclosure. I ordered Makede to kill a goat, and managed to keep Elsa quiet while this was going on. Her self-control was astonishing, and only when the men dropped the carcass within 10 yards of her did she get up and drag it into the bush near the river. The cubs growled, snarled, and cuffed each other for the best bits of meat. Living in the bush, had certainly made them become more wild, for now they were constantly on the alert for suspicious sounds, and nearly panicked when some baboons barked. The two little cubs were shyer than ever, but to my surprise, Jesper came up to me, tilted his head on one side with a questioning look, licked my arm, and plainly wished to remain friends. As I watched them, I humbly remembered Makede's reprimand for my lack of faith. In order to try to discover what they'd been up to during their long absence, I'd asked Makede to follow the spoor which Elsa had made when she arrived in camp. Meanwhile, I dressed her wound while she was too sleepy to object to the treatment. When it got dark, I went to the tents to hear Makede's report. He told me he had traced her to the limit of her territory, and that there on some rocky outcrops he'd found not only her pug marks and those of the cubs, but also the spoor of at least one lion, if not two. This probably explained how she and the cubs had been fed, and also accounted for her strange behaviour when she was surprised by the game scout and us, for her reactions were typical of a lioness in season. It may seem odd that this solution had not occurred to us, but as Elsa was still suckling her cubs, we had not expected her to be interested in a mate. We'd accepted the general belief that wild lionesses only produce cubs every third year, because in the interval, they're teaching the young of the last litter to hunt and become independent. Could Elsa have returned more quickly than we expected into breeding condition because of the food we had supplied? Certainly at 7.5 months, the cubs could have survived on a meat diet, and obviously she could not know that we were only staying on so as to treat her wounds and help her to get fit and able to teach her cubs hunting. At about 9 that evening, Elsa and the cubs came from the river and settled themselves in front of my tent and demanded their supper. As the remains of the meat were still by the river, I called to Makede and the Toto and asked them to help me drag it in. I collected a pressure lamp, and we went down the narrow path which we had cut through the dense bush from the camp to the river. Makede, armed with a stick and a hurricane lamp, went ahead. The Toto followed close behind, and carrying my bright light, I brought up the rear. Silently, we walked a few yards down the path. Then there was a terrific crash. Out went Makede's lamp, and a second after, mine was smashed as a monstrous black mass hit me and knocked me over. The next thing I knew was that Elsa was licking me. As soon as I could collect myself, I sat up and called to the boys. A feeble groan came from the Toto, who was lying close to me holding his head. Then he got up shakily, stammering, "Buffalo, buffalo!" At this moment, we heard Makede's voice coming from the direction of the kitchen, saying that he was all right. As we pulled ourselves together, the Toto told me that he had seen Makede suddenly jump to the side of the path and hit out with his stick at a buffalo. The next moment the Toto had been knocked down and I had been overrun. What had happened when Elsa met the buffalo face to face, none of us will ever know. Luckily the Toto had no worse injury than a bump on his head, caused by falling against a palm trunk. I felt blood running down my arms and thighs and was in some pain, but I wanted to get home before examining my wounds. This incident certainly belied the popular belief that a lion, however tame, becomes savage at the scent or taste of blood. Elsa, who had obviously come to protect us from the buffalo, seemed to realize that we were hurt and was most gentle and affectionate. I received several kicks, which left their marks on my thighs, and I could only feel thankful that they had not landed on more vulnerable parts of my anatomy. I was worried about Makede, and went at once to the kitchen to see what condition he was in. There I found him unhurt and having a splendid time, recounting to his awestruck friends his single-handed combat with the buffalo. I'm afraid his heroic stature was slightly diminished by the appearance of my bleeding legs, but the main thing was that we were all safe. The next afternoon, Elsa took great care to drag her kill a long way upstream and to straddle it across the river, and then up a bank which was so steep it was unlikely that any beast would come after it. I wondered whether this behaviour was due to her having been as frightened by the buffalo as I had been. By the beginning of August, George had rejoined me and had brought an anti-poaching team, one that operates throughout the northern frontier. The first thing he now wanted them to do was to find some man belonging to the tribe on the far side of the river, who for a suitable reward would supply information about the poachers. As soon as the team was established, we had every intention of leaving Elsa and her family to look after themselves. Her wounds were more or less healed, and we wanted the lions to lead a natural life. But when the scouts returned, we found that we had to change our plans. They brought in some prisoners, and an informer told George that the poachers had determined to kill Elsa with poisoned arrows as soon as we left the camp. We realized that as the drought increased, so would the poachers' activities. And however efficient the anti-poaching team might be, it would be impossible for them to prevent Elsa, if unfed by us, from hunting further afield and risking an encounter with the tribesmen. Obviously, if we stayed on, the cubs' education in wildlife would be delayed, and they would probably get spoilt. But it was better to face this than risk a tragedy. One evening the tsetseflies were particularly active, and Elsa and her two sons rolled on their backs inside my tent, trying to squash their tormentors. In doing so, they knocked down two camp beds, which were propped up against the wall. Elsa lay down on one of them, and Jesper on the other, while Gopa had to be content with the ground sheet. The sight of two lions lolling in bed, while far from our ideal picture of Elsa's family returned to a wild life, was comic enough. Only little Elsa stayed outside. She was as wild as ever, and nothing would induce her to enter the tent, so she at least appeased my conscience. On the 12th of August, I went to Nairobi for 6 days, and returned on the 18th. I approached Elsa, calling to her, but as she looked at me through half-closed eyes, I kept on my guard while she came slowly towards me, and I was justified. For when she was within 10 yards of me, she charged at full speed, knocked me down, sat on me, and then proceeded to lick me. She was extremely friendly, so this, it seemed, was no more than her idea of a game. But she knew quite well that the knocking down trick was not popular with us, and this was the first time since the birth of the cubs that she had indulged in it. Later, she took the cubs to a place below the studio, and we joined them there. Jesper was very much interested in George's rifle, and tried his best to snatch it away from him, but he soon realized that it was impossible to do this so long as its owner was on his guard. After this discovery, it was amusing to see how he tried to distract George's attention by pretending to chase his brother and sister. When George's suspicions were allayed, and he put the rifle down, Jesper pounced on it and straddled it. A real tug of war followed, which Elsa watched attentively. At last, she came to George's rescue by sitting on her son and thereby forcing him to release his hold. She continued to sit on the cub for such a long time that I got worried about him. When she finally released him, though he looked longingly at the rifle, he was very subdued and left it alone. Finally, Elsa rolled over on her back with her paws in the air and moaned softly. The cubs responded at once and began suckling. Elsa looked utterly happy, but I could not help wondering how the cubs avoided hurting her with their sharp teeth. It was a most idyllic scene, and just at that moment a paradise flycatcher flew over us, trailing its white tail feathers like a long train behind it. The cubs were 8 months old that day, and she had every reason to be proud of them. When they dozed off, Elsa got up, came over to me, licked me, sat beside me and rested her paw on my shoulder for some time. Then she put her head on my lap and went to sleep. There was a truly Garden of Eden atmosphere about life around the precincts of the camp, for the animals who shared this territory with us had got so used to our presence that they often came very close without showing alarm. I thought that if it were not threatened by the poachers, wild life here would be ideal. For even the fierce lioness is much less of a danger to Elsa than these men. In any case, she is a natural part of bush life, so are feuds between lions. At the beginning of September, we heard that Sir Julian Huxley was soon coming on a mission sponsored by UNESCO to investigate the problem of the conservation of wildlife in East Africa. When he wrote asking us if we could show him part of the